finish this.
Okay, we're not going to finish this, but we are going to start this. Okay.
All
right, we're going to finish the book. Yeah, yeah, we're going to finish it. Okay, today is session 4, class 4, and we began looking at this mitzvah number 95, the precept of building the holy temple, at the end of last year. We're going to review a little bit and hopefully finish this mitzvah, but I think what we're going to do right now is start a unit on the temple and do the temple mitzvahs as...
Everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere, all together, so that we do... Starting with building the temple, and we'll do
that would be great.
So I think it might even take us till Hanukkah. I'm not quite sure how many and what all the information that we'll bring in. We'll see. Right, so I have to find them all and I have to do that research, which is part of my plan. So
tell us which books to bring.
And tell you which books to bring. So if it's not this book, I will send you an email, Blee Netter, on which book to bring per class. But that is my hope right now, is to do a temple unit starting with this mitzvah.
That's great.
So, because we have this chunk of time here without holidays interrupting anything,
so
we might as well this as a chunk right now, so we can see the whole kind of overview. So, I've made 2 pages. We'll see how much we get through today, because there's really quite a bit. But it's a fascinating, long piece, and I think it's worth it for everybody to read it inside, depending on if you want to do homework or not. But it's a nice long thing. It has lots of information in it. So, it starts off with... building the temple, of course. So, and it comes from the verse, and let them make me a sanctuary, va'asuli mikdash, right? Vishachanti, and everybody knows the end of that, right? We've talked about, how does that pasuk go? Va'asuli mikdash, vishachanti, fill in the blank. Make for me a mikdash, and I will dwell
amongst you.
Right. So we know that the commentators discuss that. What does that mean? Make for me a mikdash, and it should be make for me a mikdash, and I will dwell in it.
Right.
But it's not. It's dwell amongst you. So that fits in with our discussion of the commandments all the way through, that the commandments are not about the commanded thing, but rather about shaping us into vessels to hold God. So this is the commandment, to build a dwelling place for God. And so there are specific measurements and heights and materials and procedures to build it. But in the end, the place that God lives is in us, because we are transformed by the process of building this. So the place he wants to live is inside of us. So it starts off by saying that. It starts off by saying, how could we know anything? Right, so how much can we know? It's so vast. And I think that this is very helpful for anybody who's trying to learn a lot and feels like they don't have enough time to learn everything that they want to learn, whether it's in a day or in a lifetime, when you feel very hungry for all that knowledge. So it really talks about how there's 70 facets to the Torah. I mean, it's a whole long introduction. Most of the mitzvahs, as we've seen, because he has a very strong contrast in the way he approaches this mitzvah from all the other ones. All the other ones, he gives the verse, and then how you do it, right? The reason for it, how you do it, who does it, you know, who it applies to, and what's the punishment for not doing it. This is very long. It does not follow that order. So, I mean, it has elements of that order in it, but it doesn't follow that. It starts off with a lot of philosophy, and there's philosophy throughout. So it starts out by giving the verse, which is how they all start. And then the root, it says that everyone who comes near he gives a lot of different verses. Anyone who comes near will be purified, and everyone who raises up will be raised up and sanctified. But that doesn't really say the root, except for it is a mikdash, a holy maker. That's what a sanctuary is, sanctified, making holy. So the Beit HaMikdash is the house of making things sanctified, making things holy. So how will one become, really the best definition for holy is separate. L'kadesh something is to separate it out. Separate it out. So, because holy in English has a different connotation. And it does mean holy, but something that's sanctified means something that's set apart for a specific purpose. Which is why when we get married, our husbands say, Hare at mikudeshet li. You are consecrated unto me. You're separated out now from the group of all the women in the world, and you're just for me, separated out for me. So, and we as a people then have to be separated out from all the peoples of the world, separated out for God. And anything that's for the temple is separated out from all the stuff of the world, just for that service. So, and anything from our flocks that we use to offer in the temple is separated out just for that. So that's what holy in this context means, separate it out for that specific purpose. So how do we separate ourselves out? God separated us, but then it's our job to do the work of it. So it is through this process of the Beit HaMikdash. It says, with all this wisdom, with all this knowledge, with all these 70 facets of the Torah and the myriad roots on page 357, as every root has branches, each of which bears a great cluster of desirable fruit to make hearts wise. There's blossoms, and everybody who studies those blossoms will gain wisdom, and yet it's so much wisdom. How will we ever grasp all that wisdom? And I think it's interesting, this sentence, the depth of its wisdom, anybody who studies it, here, this could be exciting and frustrating at the same time. The depth of its wisdom widens and winds about until a man has not the power to grasp its ultimate sense.
So it gets bigger and bigger.
It gets so big.
The more you know, the less you know.
Right. I think it's fascinating, though, that the way it says it, it widens and then winds about. So kind of like morning glories, first it widens into a chasm and then it winds about you until, which means at first you do understand it, until you don't understand it. The more you study it, the less you understand it.
You see greater meaning in it.
Well, but I think what it's saying is the more you study it, the less you understand it. Because you at first you can grasp something. But the more you study it, the more you realize you can't. Which is okay.
That's true in a lot of areas of Judaism.
Yes. But it's starting with this principle.
If you're getting a handle on something,
sort of slithers away.
Right. So in a way, it should be, rather than disappointing or frustrating, like, I thought I understand that, and now it's slipping out of my fingers, really, you should be excited and say, wow, I got to the point where I totally don't get it. That's so exciting.
Human nature.
If you move past that point of feeling like you understand it into a place of, wow,
I don't get it,
then you know you've achieved something in your learning.
Try and keep that in mind.
Right, to get to that place. Right? So, meanwhile, the second paragraph says, with all that, however, so with all that frustrating aspect of it, that the wisdom is far from me, the hands of anyone who occupies himself with it should not be slackened. So keep going. For if he eats a little or much of it, it is all sweet. And if there are many whose hand will not attain to take the fruit of the trees of the garden, let them take themselves its leaf for healing. So even if you can't get to the main thing, at least take the outside edges. So I, although I know its great worth and immense depth, and that it is too wondrous for me, too exalted, as it says in Psalms, I have opened my mouth wide to speak of it, relying on what my master teachers have taught me. Let a man pound away at his study, even if he does not know what he is saying. As it is stated, my soul pounds on with longing. So that's an important thing for all of us, even though we can't get it, really. You know, as far as we go, keep going, it's worth it. Even if you only get crumbs on the edges, it's totally worth the effort. So so that's the first thing in our sense. How much can we know? It's so vast. We can't.
We can't
know it all. And yet, it's worth it. It is so vast. But once we get to see the vastness, we know we've achieved something. You know, like going to the top of Pikes Peak. How amazing it is to see. You can see from Montana to New Mexico. It's amazing. It's huge.
It was a
gorgeous day yesterday. You really could see all the way from state to state. Right? You have achieved something. You get to the top. You're like, you feel like you're on the top of the world there. It's not the Himalayas or the Himalayas, as they say in that region, but you're really on the top of Colorado. You can really see quite a bit from there. So you have achieved something. When you get to the distance, you'll see the vastness, and then you see how far you couldn't actually achieve, and yet being able to see it is something. It is worth the effort to at least get to that place. So what do we know? So this is a paragraph that we did look at last time, and I think it's an extremely important concept to know again and again. So this is a principle that he lays down. Know, my son, that all that is attained in regard to the eternal Lord when people observe all his mitzvot is only this. So this is what you get from keeping the mitzvahs. It's the desire of the eternal Lord to do us good. And as a man becomes capable and ready by observing those precepts to receive the good, then the eternal Lord grants him beneficence. He therefore made them know the good way, so that they may be good, this being the way of the Torah. For by it, a man becomes good. Consequently, anyone who fulfills his precepts fulfills his desire, by being worthy then to receive his beneficence. On the other hand, if any person does not prepare for himself for this, his evil is great, for he knows wherein the desire of the eternal Lord lies, yet he carries out his deeds in opposition to his desire. So he's clear here. The whole purpose of Torah and mitzvahs is that God wants to give us good, but we have to be able to receive it. So the whole purpose of doing Torah and mitzvahs is to shape ourselves into containers for the goodness. That's it. There is no other purpose. It's just to create ourselves into as great a container as we can so God can give us as much good as possible. It's up to us to shape. God's flow of goodness is constant, and we just have to shape ourselves into containers to receive it. And we do that through the Torah and mitzvahs. So there's that principle. It is for our good. So, and we see that then from this verse in the Torah, from Deuteronomy 10:12, where he says, what does God want from you? Just that you should do good. Let me see if I'll, and he quotes the Rambam. It's based on the Rambam, so I brought the Rambam to read to you. Okay, so what the verse is 10:12. What does the eternal thy God require of you? Just to walk in his ways and do good. For, and the end of the verse, that's 10:12, the end of verse 13 is for your good. I should have brought the whole two verses. But the end is for your good. So it's very clear that what does God want of you, ... for your good, just to do these things. So it's not what does God want of you for his sake, because whatever we do for God is meaningless. We can't give God or take from God anything. God is immutable. Judaism is immutable. Torah is immutable. There's no way that we could add or diminish. It's not possible. So whatever we do in the ultimate sense, in a way, is insignificant when it has to do with God. And yet it's of total significance just because God wants to give to us. So it's only for our good, not for God's good.
That's the ending of
Kohelet. Right, right.
That's
he quotes
Kohelet. It's my favorite book of the writings, is because that's basically what it says. It goes through all this wanging, you know, but at the end, it culminates in, so what is left for us to do? And it's to follow God's commandments and to do his will.
So, unlike man's relationship to everything else around him and in the world, where we have a duty not only to receive but also to give, we have obligations to do that. With respect to our relationship with Hashem, basically our job is to receive if we have put ourselves into the proper place.
Right. You're right. Mm-hmm. You're right.
I mean, and that's sort of an interesting
You're right.
thing.
That's the paradox, is that our whole function in relationship to God is to receive. That's what she's saying.
Yes,
but the only way that we can accomplish
it is
by giving.
Right.
Right.
But with respect
right.
to...
That is the paradox.
Which is very... I mean, it is an interesting...
Yes. That is the paradox. That it, so the way that works is... Right. That's excellently observed. The paradox is our relationship with God is to receive. Our relationship with everything else is to give. Sometimes we have to receive. But our relationship, really, our primary pathway is to give to everything else. We can't give to God. Our job is to receive from God, but how can we receive? Only by being a giver. So how does that work? Through emulating God, we can receive God's goodness. We want to be in a relationship with God, so we have to be like God to be in that relationship. What God is and the way that we know God is through God's gifts, only through the way that he gives. So the way that we can emulate God is by doing what God does, which is giving. The more that we give, the more we can receive what God gives. So exactly, our relationship with God is to be a receiver. Our relationship with everything else is to be a giver. Right. So this is what the Ramban says. This is Ramban at the end, Nachmanides. On the verse, what doth the eternal thy God require of thee? This is connected with the expression in the following verse, for thy good. He is stating he does not require anything of you for his sake, only for your sake. Similar in meaning to the verse, if thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Rather, it is all for your good. And he stated the reason for it, because unto the eternal thy God belongeth the heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth with all that therein is, all giving glory to his name, and he is not in need of you. Only the eternal delighted in thy fathers to love them, and he chose their seed after them, even you, above all the peoples. For you are chosen of their seed, not Ishmael or Esav, which is interesting that it says in here. So we're the chosen ones, right? And it's interesting, even my husband's...
The Islamists in here, that would take offense.
Yes, it's true.
PC, non-PC
statement. Not PC at all, but although it's interesting in the Torah, my husband's learning an aliyah for my niece's benot mitzvah, twin nieces. So I was driving his car, and the aliyah was in it, because he's practicing while he's driving, right? So I heard it as I'm going to King Super's a few times, because he has it just on repeat. So so it's the aliyah of, it's the end of Parshas Chayesara, where it says, let's see, and Abraham had children with Keturah and concubines, and at the end of his days, he gave everything to his son Isaac. Everything goes to him, and to the rest of his children, he sends them, he gives them gifts and sends them to the east, eastwards. So he uses east both times. East, eastwards. But everything is given to his son Isaac while he's still alive. So it's very clear that the whole inheritance goes through Isaac and not through anybody else. He does have other children, that's also very clear, but they don't inherit. They inherit some things, they inherit some ideas, but they don't inherit his line, his transmission, his purpose in the world. That all channels through Isaac. So that's very clear in the verses. That's not even a commentary. And then sending them east with gifts is our commentary on that, is that's where the Eastern religions come from. All the Kabbalah that's in Buddhism and Brahmism, even Brahma sounds like Avraham. And it starts about the same time. Brahma and what's the other one named? Shiva. No, but there's another one that sounds like Sarah. Anyway, the gods can sound like that.
Oh, Buddhist.
Uh-huh. Buddhist and Hindu. The Hindu gods.
Those are Hindu,
the Hindu gods,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. So my understanding is that Buddhism isn't actually technically a theology, but it's a spiritual system that meshes with other theologies.
Is it? I know that as Jews, we're not supposed to study other religions.
Right.
But can you learn about them? I mean,
right.
How
so,
is the dividing thing?
Right.
There?
So that's actually an excellent question. And I just sent to Shila, and I'm going to ask him more pointedly, because I wanted to read something of Heschel's. And as I was thinking, Abraham Joshua Heschel.
Right.
I was thinking, well, should I, shouldn't I, with the limited time that I have, and I don't know enough about his philosophy to know if it's kosher or not kosher exactly, and I know it was the foundation of Reconstructionist Judaism, so then it does make a stronger question, and I was reading an old 1998 Tikkun magazine that quotes him and celebrates his 25th Yahrzeit, so Michael Lerner considers himself one of his Talmidim, so that, in a way, traces it up, you know, so like, but is it,
but,
is it,
right,
because he feels attached, or what's like,
right.
Yeah, so I don't even know, so I just sent a Shiloh to somebody, can I, can't I, should I, shouldn't I, really it was should I, shouldn't I, shouldn't, it wasn't can I, can't I, but there is a can I, can't I about learning philosophies also.
Katz wrote a book on Buddhism.
So, let's pull back for a second.
Really
so,
not on Buddhism.
No, it is
but
not on Buddhism.
Buddhism.
No, he does not.
No,
he writes, he published a book of a dialogue between him
right.
and a Buddhist Jew for a specific purpose
right.
that many Jews are attracted to Buddhism.
Right.
So how could he clarify differences and bring mm-hmm. Judaism to light? He used that conversation.
Right.
No. No.
He must have studied it. To
he
have
had to do his own study for that purpose. So there's a big question. That's why I was asking the question of this person. So I sent this question saying, given who and how I teach and what I know and my desire for broad-based knowledge and my limited time, should I study Heschel? Should I read any of the works of Heschel? And if I should, which one? Right, that was my question. So you sent me back and said, I don't know. We need to have a phone conversation about what you actually do and don't know and what blanks you should be filling in at this point, which I thought, yeah, actually, I probably should take an inventory of everything I know and really think about how should I be spending my time, not just where am I curious, but really think about a comprehensive strategy for where I should be filling in blanks. So that's why you have a Rebbe. I don't have a Rebbe yet, but that is somebody that I turn to. So I think that's important to really look you know, to somebody who knows more than you to ask a question like that. I wasn't asking it that way. And that was the right response, really, was let's discuss where your empty places are and what should be filled, how you will use your time to fill it. Right, right. So
getting back to that.
So the question is, can you? So the first answer is no. And the second answer is yes.
Okay.
So the first answer is no. You should not be studying other religions, especially when you're not strong in your Jewish knowledge. And we're, as we see here, we can never be strong enough, right? And we never have enough time. Never. So how should you be using your time, and how should you be using your mind? That's also the argument against watching movies. Not that we don't at all, but we should be thinking about how do we use our time, and how do we use our emotions and our minds? Should we be reading that, or shouldn't we be reading that? Should we be learning that? Should we be spending our free time that way, or shouldn't we be spending our free time that way? But with respect to learning about other religions, it's even stronger, because especially if we're less knowledgeable or less anchored, it can pull us. We can read things that make sense and say, oh my gosh, that really seems to work. And I don't see that in Judaism. That's why Buddhism is so dangerous for American Western Jews, because it is so inviting. It has so much in it. Judaism has all of that, but we don't know it. And we don't have easy access to it. It is not as accessible at all.
But I guess the question is, I can sort of see that answer if you're a person who's like seeking something and you're looking to this as a potential source.
Right.
You know, then I can see the danger and the pull push and the appealing and the, you know, and all of that. Uh-huh. But if that's not it at all.
What if you're not seeking? What if you're an intellectually curious person
and
you just want to learn?
Well, and you're just
right. Okay. So now that's where the yes answer comes in. So the no is for most people. The yes is where you have a specific purpose for it. Specific purpose, I don't think, includes general curiosity. Mm. I don't think so. I don't think it's safe. It has to be a specific purpose. Somebody is asking you to comment on it. Your child is interested in Buddhism.
So that would be
you need to learn something about it so you can show them how Judaism has that. Yeah, yeah. Then, absolutely. And be careful what you're studying. Make sure you're grounded. Daven before. Something like that. Say, and state the purpose. I am doing this for the sake of anchoring my child or my student. Or I have a doubt. I am doing this to discover the root of that and how I could work on that. And then do that in concert with somebody so that you're not heading into risky territory, because it can be risky.
So you're saying pure intellectual curiosity is not a good
reason. No, it's not. No, because we have so much in Judaism where we can take ourselves with intellectual curiosity. And many people study Judaism for pure intellectual curiosity and take themselves to places where they're not moving at all either. It shouldn't. Pure intellectual curiosity should not be what drives us. And we can get stuck as Jews in that, because we do value the mind and the intellect so much that we could stop at the value of the mind and the intellect without moving it into the connection of the spirit, which we'll see just down here. But yeah, pure question is not enough.
It's so difficult then to obtain. I mean, that's something I've heard, that people say, oh, you know, they didn't think Judaism, you know,
right,
you hear
spiritual
about people could do,
right,
that they didn't have it, and so they were going to search out other, but it is in Judaism. If,
right,
you just look inside Judaism. But why is it so difficult,
right,
to find? Why?
So there's a few reasons for that. Right. That's an excellent question. So I think, yeah, one reason.
Except on Simchas Torah.
Even on Simchas Torah. Yeah, for sure. I would say, well, let's start with the spiritual reason, which is that God has a plan for the Jews, a big plan for the Jews, and it requires us to be put in many different circumstances throughout history for each generation to be able to actualize that generation's power. So that being said, some generations needed to be put in a test of Shabbos. You know, you have to work 7 days. You have to work 7 days just to eat. And you're going to be fired if you don't work 7 days. So you were tested in Shabbos. This is not our test at all, in the least. But it's not what we have to reveal in the world, right? And there were tests of convert or die. That's not our test. And there are tests of be extremely wealthy and try to connect. Even that's not our test in this generation. Although be distracted and connect, that is our test, right? For sure. Be comfortable and connect is our test. But there's more than that. So first of all, we just have to see that through every generation, there are specific circumstances that God arranges for us, that each generation as a group needs to collectively work on a concept, and then within that, each individual has their concept that they need to work on. So it's totally there in Judaism, and you see, the more you learn Jewish history, the more you see themes in different generations or chunks of time. Why did the Kabbalists in Sfat flourish so much and come up with all the stuff that they had, or have access to all that information, where 300 years before, it wasn't there? It was there, but nobody was talking about it, right? So why? So that's why did we have classical music all revealed at the same time? Why didn't the Greeks and the Romans figure out violins and stringed instruments like they did with Beethoven in Beethoven's time? Why didn't we figure out science? You know, the way, I mean, there are chunks of periods of history where things are granted from heaven for revelation for human beings that we don't necessarily see as revelation, but you can definitely, as you look at history, you see chunks of information revealed to human beings. Humans aren't necessarily smarter. You know, if you look back at Greco-Roman times, they were smart people. The architecture they had, the sciences that they had, we went into periods of darkness. Right. Why? So answer number one, spiritual journey that God is putting us through for each generation to do its own thing. So we are in a time period where we have to dig deeper for some of that stuff. So that, I would say, is the first answer, and you just to see it as a bigger wave of history that we're living through. But then if you want to try to look at, skip the spiritual and try to look at natural causes for it, which I believe are driven by the spiritual, but the natural causes would be from the time of those Kabbalists in Sfat and throughout much of our history, we've been poor, sick, killed, chased. So really hard to be scholars, really hard to look for meaning because your meaning was mainly stay alive. So this last 100 years, and not even 100 years, this last
not even, right.
60 years, and not even since 1945, since 45 was still survival, from the mid-50s, certainly the 60s, where not just the Jews, but the whole world, the whole Western world, started to look for meaning, started to want to break free of confines and look for what's really meaningful in the world. Right? So that got all mixed up, too. But if you think about it, if you're looking at waves of history, so that was really the first time in history that we were wealthy enough and free enough to be able to look at ourselves and say, what am I doing here? What's my real purpose? Where should I be headed? Right? That's the first time in history as a group that we've been able to really ask that on a large scale. So, and there have been individuals, certainly founding fathers and, you know, the John Lockes and the Adam Smiths and all those people, but it wasn't a generational concern. That was the first time it was a generational concern. So, but as a generation, then God always provides us wrong answers and right answers so that we get to pick. Right? It's up to us to choose which path we want to walk on, but the collective energy of the generation is seek meaning. So we are seeking meaning. There's many different ways to seek meaning, but it's harder to seek it in Jewish because, A, people are trying to shrug off boundaries and requirements and restrictions, and Judaism had kind of been diminished into that in the eyes of many because we had gone through several centuries of lack of learning on a collective scale because it had been so involved in just living. So it did kind of drive that information deeper and deeper or make it lost because people only had a chance to study how do you keep Shabbos and how do you live and how do you survive in this world. There wasn't a lot of room for more study than that. So even though that existed, it kind of was on the side. It was harder to find. So, and it's attached to mitzvahs. Our Jewish philosophy can't be philosophy by itself. That's why the whole Kabbalah movement is a joke. And even, and I hope it grows into more, but even the current Musar movement, internet-based and class-based, it's good, and it's not enough because it's not predicated on mitzvah observance. The whole point of Musar is not personal growth. It's how do I connect myself to Torah?
Isn't Musar personal growth? Isn't that the definition?
No, it is not the definition. If it's personal growth, you can have it outside of Torah. Then read Stephen Covey. Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? I mean, if it's not Stephen Covey, Stephen Covey's fabulous. I love him. I'm also one of his Talmidim. I think Stephen Covey is great. Mm-hmm. But he is not Torah at all. And he's not a Rebbe at all. He's just growth. Right? Musar is not just growth. Mussar is how do I grow through Torah? So if it's not through Torah, it's not how do I grow. It's how do I grow through Torah? How do I get my Torah to affect me? So it's completely different. And if you have it outside of Torah, it's not Mussar, and it's just personal growth. So Mussar, Torah, the Torah growth that's available is predicated on mitzvahs. So we've discussed before and used the language before of container and contents, right? So a container is what holds the contents. Contents is what's important that you want to be held, that needs to be held, right? So what's the most important thing to the Jew? A relationship with God. Right? Dveikus, connecting with God. Total connection and blending in with God. That's really the ultimate of every Jew. Male, female, rich, poor, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, whatever you are, the main thing is to connect with God to a point where you totally blend. I know that bothers certain people where they feel like they have to give up their individuality. And yet, in the end, that's how you achieve the most individuality, but it is by giving it up. There's also a paradox there. So that's for a different discussion. But the idea here is that total dveikus is the goal. How can you achieve that? Only through building a container that holds it. Otherwise, it runs all over the place. And I've seen that in people. I've seen that in the human potential movement, and I've seen that in new agey people, and I've seen that in people who are kind, very kind, but they run up against the edges of their own personal kindness. They can only be as kind as they are, not kinder, because that's just how nice they are. That's just how giving they are. If they want to be kinder or more giving or more good or more deep, they have to attach themselves to something that's bigger than them. And what's bigger than them is the Torah. So you can only be as big as you are if you're only doing what you do. So if you want to be bigger, you have to attach to bigger. If you want to grow, you have to attach to that. So the way that you do that is halacha, Torah and mitzvahs. You have to create a container with halacha. But, as I said, some people just create the container and never fill it. So there are people who are all about Torah and mitzvahs, and they're the most empty people. Some people who are very empty because they've focused only on halacha. But halacha is not the main thing. It's the prerequisite. It's necessary. You can't do anything without halacha. But if you don't fill that container, you have nothing in the end. Or not much. You have little dregs.
Fill it with musar,
fill it with your relationship with God. Dveikus. Yeah. Right. I mean, Rabbi Feldheim was saying, he expressed it in a different way. In one of his classes, he said, imagine you have a shop owner, right? And he's got a shop full of wares. And every day he comes, he opens the store, he sells his stuff, and takes inventory and orders more stuff and accounts, you know, makes his accounts and keeps his books. So what is the point of the store? What is the point of the store?
To sell.
To make money.
Right. If your thing is to sell stuff, right, that's the people who think that Torah mitzvahs, right, so yes, it's to sell, but in the end, it's to make money. The whole point of the store is to make money. So why sell stuff that sells well, but you don't make a profit on it? If you think, right, it's just to sell, if you're going to make up in quantity what you're lacking in quality, right, you know, you sell it. That's the joke that, you know, if you sell
make
something, right, make it up in volume, you're selling at a loss, but you'll make it up in volume, right?
We know people right? whose businesses run that way.
Right, yeah. So there are people whose businesses, because they're making a mistake. They think the point
volume,
is to sell.
They think the volume is the key as
right.
opposed to the profit.
Right. The profit is the key. The whole reason you have the store is to make a profit. That's the whole point. If you're not making a profit, close your store. Do something else. You need to make money. So the whole point of mitzvahs is not mitzvahs. It's to have a relationship with God.
And then if you're really good at that store, the real point of making money is to get it stuck up.
Well, so the idea is, what's the point of the store?
Vision.
The point of the store is to make money, right? So that, because it's a muscle here.
Right.
Yes, correct. The real point of money is to live, not to accrue money.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. So, but you have to ask, so what's the point of what you're doing? I mean, I ask people this, you know, people who are religious, so what's the point of your life? To serve God. Why? I mean, to serve God, yes, but to serve God, that answer is to sell the stuff. No! The point is to have a relationship with God. The point is dveikus. You're serving God in order to, because God doesn't need you at all. He could really, in a way.
The serving concept goes back to the giving.
Right.
As opposed to the receiving.
Right. The whole point is to receive goodness. You know, I've had a lot of very religious people who have been very bothered by the concept that when I say the purpose of the world is pleasure, to get pleasure. And there are a lot of people who feel uncomfortable with that. What do you mean to get pleasure? That's the whole purpose? Yes, that's the whole purpose, to get pleasure. It's all about getting pleasure. Receive, receive, receive.
But isn't that sort of a distinction between Judaism and a lot of other religions? Because, I mean, if you think back on the priests and all that with the self-flagellation and the denial
yes.
of relationships and all.
Yes.
I mean, it's a whole paradigm that's like 180 degrees opposite.
Yes. Yes. And
it goes back to the sin, you know, that you're all sinners. So.
Right. So that's where the advantage of having God give you your system comes over having you make it up yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and especially because if you're making it up yourself, you're looking at the God system and thinking that you understand parts. We have offerings, they have offerings. We have sacrifices, they have sacrifices. If you don't understand the purpose of a sacrifice, you might think it's to sacrifice something, right?
Right?
Whether it's to appease, whether it's to give up something that you like, whether, I mean, if you don't get it, then you're just gonna make up your whole own system. Right, so if you think that fasting is about harming yourself, so then why not a whole month of that? You know, what?
There you go.
Right, if you're making it up, you can make it up, and you can make all kinds of mistakes of all kinds of things. If you think that holiness is about disengaging from the physical because you see some disengagement in the mother religion, so then you're going to make all your priests be celibate because they want to be holier, so they disengage. That's a mistake. So that's where the problem comes when you're trying to make up your own system. And even people who are making up their own system may have some spiritual astuteness, like a Stephen Covey. I do believe that there are, we, as I've mentioned before, Torah is the blueprint of the world, and just like any astute architect can derive a blueprint from a building, so a spiritually astute person can derive some parts of Torah from looking at the world and then add in their own pieces. So it's the own pieces that they add in that can mix up the whole thing. So, and that's where the tricky part comes in studying other religions. You know, I definitely experienced that when I listened to that whole book, right?
Right,
so it was definitely fascinating, and I felt like I had a toilet in doing it, a positive, constructive purpose in listening to it. And I felt like I was right on the edge also, because, so on the one hand, I learned a lot of things from it, not just about that religion, but even I got insight into Judaism, because how I was thinking, and I saw Kabbalistic things that helped me understand some concepts, and yet you never know which parts of that are totally treif, and especially if you have less knowledge, then it's so, so risky, because you might swallow something and think, well, that's how it works, and it takes forever until that's undone, you know, because we just talked about how knowledge works. At first you understand it, and the more you learn, until you get to the point where you see you can't understand it, it takes a while. So if you get to that place where you think you understand it, that holds you there. Right? We've talked about in terms of a Musar concept before, that if you know it, you can't learn it. That's my mantra. If you know it, you can't learn it. You have to know you don't know it to be able to learn it. There has to be an empty space inside to fill. If you've closed the door because you learned that, then you're done learning that. You have to know you don't know it. So it's very risky to come to a place where you feel like you grasped something.
But you have to know enough to know that you don't know it.
Right.
Which goes back to the thing that we were reading earlier about
right.
sort of...
Right. Right. So you can just be in that place. Yes, we want to all get to the place where we've grasped something and move past it, because that's the real depth of knowledge. But at least we could get to the almost false place, but real place as mature adults around this table to say, it's important to know that I don't know. And I never can know it all. And that's fine. I'll just learn whatever I can. So at least if we have that concept, that can help us a lot. To always remember that I've just learned something about this. I haven't learned this.
Don't you think that's where Pardes comes in, the acronyms? Because in Judaism, you have all different levels of understanding and absorption. Starting
right.
with the Peshat,
right.
you know the little acronym of Pardes. And so you can stop it at Peshat. You can stop at... Midrash.
Remez, Remez, Drash,
and you stop at Midrash. you can stop any place in there, really, kind of if you want to, but to explore all the different levels of maybe a particular topic or portion of Judaism, then you go all the way to the Sod. Some people are happy with stopping at the Peshat, and they think, I've got it.
Well, so that's the mistake. Yeah, that's the mistake.
I know.
Right? The mistake is to stop somewhere. It's okay to say, I am resting here, and it might be permanent. Yeah, I might not be going further on this concept.
I've got it.
No, so the trick is to think that you haven't got it.
Then you realize that the rem is, there's more here than what.
Right, but what I'm saying is it's actually deeper. So you could, the initial way of learning is to learn something and then realize later that that wasn't it, it's now this. And then realize later when you learn more that that wasn't it, it's now this. Or, now that we're learning it this way, we can all know, start our learning with,
right.
I don't know it. I just learned something about it.
Yes.
And to always keep that in mind.
Right.
That we're not stopping at any place.
Yeah.
We might not go further, but we're not stopping. There's a difference.
Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is we need to change our paradigm to realize. Of course, some people stop there. What I'm saying is we all have to know. We don't know it. Doesn't mean we have to learn it. It does mean that it's worth it to learn what we are learning, and we should remember that we don't know it. So even if we've learned a chunk, just say, that's an interesting piece of information about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. It's not, now I know that subject. It's just, that was interesting to learn that piece of information about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I want to go back to where you said, you know, we have to emulate God by giving
uh-huh.
or for God to be able to give to us.
Right.
Are you talking about, I mean, we all know, like, people that take advantage,
mm-hmm.
that want to take and take and take and take.
Right.
And take. And it frustrate us because of that. Is it our job to give like Hashem gives to his children, even though he's frustrated with our house?
Yes and no.
With
that would be your mantra for the day.
Yeah, sorry, mantra for the, so I'll give you an example. Yes, when my 16-year-old son comes to me after the bris and says, I think I should sue you guys for mutilating me. Right?
Find a lawyer in the family.
I need to know. Right. Find a lawyer in the family. So he probably would ask because he has Asperger's.
Yeah.
Because he has Asperger's, because he doesn't get social things. So he doesn't get, we just came back from a simcha. We did not push you to go at all. We get that you're not happy with it. But to then say that when we come back, right? So then you have the opportunity to practice being insulted and not taking insult. Right? To just say, I'm going to be like God here. And understand that you don't get it. And I don't have to be insulted. I have to engage with you and say, then move out of my house. What do you think? You're going to eat my food while you're thinking about suing me? For, like, really?
I'm 16. I don't eat much.
I don't need to think that way.
No,
I can just give and give. So what I'm saying, right.
Somebody that wants to stay with us.
Right.
Every time there's a break. Okay. A yeshiva boy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Calls yesterday and says, can I, first of all, he was supposed to call and tell us he needed to stay with us for Sukkot, but he decided he was staying with somebody else. We never heard until we inquired, like, 2 days before. Now he wants to stay with us. He called me yesterday. Oh, this person I've been staying with is going out of town. Can I stay with you starting tomorrow through Motzei Shabbos? And I just feel like, okay,
right.
I should give without saying a word.
So yes, so that's what I'm saying, the yes and the no. So in my own case, with a child that's mine, that I understand there's a deficit there, so give, give, give. And God does that for us. Give,
okay.
Give, give. How do we eat a cheeseburger? Only because God gives our nerves power and our breath and our mind the ability to put it in our mouth, chew it, and digest it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
God gives us that, even though we're insulting him. While we're doing it, he's giving us everything to be able to do the insult.
Mm-hmm.
That's the quality of God. He's insulted and doesn't take insult. So it is our job to give, give, give. On the other hand, we do have to protect our capacity to give.
Well, I feel like I'm going to be giving with some resentment.
Right. So that's a personal thing to work on.
I see this person every day.
Right.
And I didn't get any advance notice when
right.
he knew this person was going out of town.
Right. So that's where that's a personal thing that we could work on. So let's just talk conceptually.
Me,
yeah.
Totally. I know myself.
Right.
When
so
I'm upset, it comes through.
You have to know yourself.
In one form or another, I haven't mastered the art of.
Right.
You just did it. I don't get credit for the NEPA because I resent it.
You'll get credit for working on it.
What do you do? Can I say, you know, next time we require a week's notice?
You could say that, or you could say please, or you could take the moment to educate. One of my parenting mantras is educate, don't berate.
Right. Okay.
So you could say, this person needs to be educated, and sit them down and say, listen, I'm happy. I am happy to give you a gift.
He's an older kid.
Oh, whatever. I'm happy to give you a present. I want you to understand that it's a gift. We are feeding you. We are taking time for you. We are making a bed for you. We are doing laundry for you. We are having you fill up our psychic space. I'm willing to give you that present. I would appreciate you realizing that it's a present. I don't owe you. You're not my child. You're part of Kol Yisrael. I care about you. But you might want to have a conversation like that. Let them know. I mean, we talk about how it's a gift that God gave us free will, and it's a gift that he let us know it. Right? And he told us that. So if you're just giving the gift, this child needs to be educated. This older child, but he's still emerging adults,
right.
Turns
really,
out, need education.
Really.
They're emerging adults. It's a whole new phase, right? The Times just discussed. They had a whole article on what's with 20-somethings.
Right.
So they gave them a new name, right? So now you have early childhood and middle school time and adolescence, early adolescence, teenagers, emerging adults, adults. Adults are 30.
He's not 30 yet, he's not there.
Right? So it's emerging adults. It doesn't matter what you think about your value judgments that they should, could, would be capable at 21. They're not. Right? So the reality is they're emerging adults, and the reality is they still need plenty of education and guidance. And so we have to give that to them. Do you have to be the one to constantly do it? If it's getting in the way of your life, you say stop. You have to, so that it depends on what that means. That's a whole private, we can have that conversation about that specific thing. But in general, we give and we grow by giving. So that is what we're supposed to be doing. We are supposed to be giving, and we have to protect our capacity to give. So that's the general principle. We're not allowed, we're supposed to give tzedakah. We are not allowed to give so much that we will require tzedakah. We're not permitted. You might think it's the most fabulous thing, give everything. Sell your home. If you sell your home and give away everything, then you're going to be forced to call somebody to live with them, right? Or you're living on the street, so now you're going to be sick, so now you're going to be forced to go to a hospital and receive tzedakah because you can't afford the bills, right? You're not allowed to do that. So it's exactly the same concept emotionally,
yeah.
Right? You have to know yourself. Hopefully you will grow in your emotional capacity to give more. But until you have, you need to know your limits,
right,
and protect your capacity to give and to live. So
my capacity has definitely grown. But
so what I'm saying is
people that continually...
Right, so you have to know your limits, and you usually only know your limits when you've crossed them.
Right.
That's how you could tell.
Yeah.
That, oh, that was my limit. Right? That's how you know. You don't, you don't usually see it in front of you. You usually see it behind. So you'll have to recoup a little bit. So you might say to him, you can stay for 3 days. That's as much as we can do. And that might be it. But you'll only know that after he stayed too long the last time. And the next time you'll say, this is what we can offer you. Right? Or whatever it is. But you do have to know your limits, and you have to protect your capacity to give. So that's the principle. There.
These breaks are 3.5 weeks long, typically. 3.5 weeks.
Right. Wow. So we'll talk. Yeah. All right. Should we go any further on this? I guess that's it for now. Okay. We'll continue next week. We have lots to go in our Beit HaMikdash series.
All right. So book one for next week.
Book one for next week.